Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Front Line.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, October 11th, 2001. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. I am on the road. We'll be back live on Thursday. Today, I've got a great interview with Mike Lofgren. He is a 30-year vet, veteran, of working for Republicans on Capitol Hill. And he retired recently and has basically written goodbye to all that. He breaks down the reality of the Republican Party and what they've become over the past 30-some-odd years as he was working on the Hill. A fascinating interview. I know you're going to enjoy it. I will be back live on Thursday. Tomorrow, we will be talking to Randall Kennedy, Harvard law professor who's written a fascinating book entitled The Color Line, and speaks of President Obama, the issue of his presidency in the context of race. A fascinating conversation. And, of course, for tomorrow, for members, you'll also hear another interview that I did with Eric Alterman on the stupidity of the media. But that's for tomorrow. For now, listen to this interview with Mike Lofgren. And folks, remember, you can support the Majority Report by becoming a member at majority.fm. It is only your support that keeps this show alive. And I need more, frankly, more members to keep the show going. And I know there are thousands of you out there who listen to the show on a daily basis. Just imagine what would happen if the show wasn't here. You'd just be listening to silence for 40 minutes a day. And now you can up how much you listen to an hour and a half a day by becoming a member. So please support the show if you can do that. Again, if you can't afford it, email me at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will work something out. I promise you. I don't want anybody who can afford who can't afford to listen to the whole show to be denied it. Because we're all suffering through difficult times. That's why you've got hundreds, if not thousands, of people down on Occupy Wall Street on a daily basis. So please, if you can become a member, please do. And support the show in our other ways by buying coffee from justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off.
Let's drill, baby, drill, not stall, baby, stall.
That woman is an idiot.
Here it is, the Republicans' health care plan for America. Don't get sick.
If you think that's a fair ad, okay, then you're a Republican and an asshole. Have at it, Hoss. Be in that party. Despicable, man.
They're the bad guys.
Endless taxpayer bailout.
Yeah, that's not true.
When Obama won, the reason why we worked so hard for him, we didn't want a garden variety politician.
Taking a stand, not just cutting deals.
That's what vision is. Yeah. That's what vision is.
The Best of the Left podcast. The best of the truly liberal media. Edited, organized, and mixed. Only at bestoftheleft.com.
All right, folks. Now there, here's that interview with Mike Lofgren. So, Mike, first off, let me ask you, just tell me what you've been doing for the past 30 years.
Well, I've been working on Capitol Hill for half that time. I was working on the House Budget Committee and the Senate Budget Committee, mainly in the area of national defense, but also doing other interesting areas like TARP and the International Monetary Fund.
And so when you work on the budget committees here, are you a Republican staffer?
That is correct.
And so, tell me something. I mean, what you've written this amazing piece, Goodbye to All That. I guess it was basically your almost a mini memoir, or maybe not so much a memoir as much as it was an assessment of what has happened to the Republican Party over those years that you worked on those committees.
Absolutely. And if I can explain, this has nothing to do with personal unhappiness or a grudge or score settling or how I was treated or any of that. It's, I think, much more important than that. I was personally treated well. I was treated as a professional. I tried to assume the persona, not as a political operative, but as a professional staff member working for the taxpayer and working on behalf of the interests of the American people. And what I saw, particularly towards the end, did not please me. I think what happened was very, it portended something very bad for representative democracy.
Now, you make the point in your piece that both parties are essentially rotten in some respect now. And I think certainly that is the sense of a lot of Americans out there who are seeing our government basically become more or less dysfunctional, and certainly dysfunctional from the perspective of the needs of a lot of Americans. But you make a distinction between the almost the generic rottenness of the Democratic Party and the truly rottenness, I guess, of the Republican Party. Just give me a snapshot of that distinction.
Well, I think by reading the piece, you see some of the aspects of it. The Republicans have sort of taken on this sort of tripartite platform of plutocrats, theocrats, and millocrats. However, that does not let the Democrats off the hook. As James Fallows, the Atlantic writer, said actually when he was commenting on my piece, that the parties don't have sort of offsetting foibles that kind of balance out in some sort of harmonic convergence. Their operational pathologies make each other's failings worse.
Hmm. All right. Well, let's talk about. I mean, first off, let's talk about this idea that you write that the crackpot outliers of two decades ago have become the virtual center of the Republican Party. Give me a sense of when you first came to the Hill. Well, you know, why were you a Republican, and at what point did you start to see the Republicans drift from those principles that drew you to that party?
Well, actually, in the early 70s, I was put off by the left wing of the Democratic Party because I saw this sort of identity politics, this kind of talk from some of the outliers there about, you know, we're going to take it to the streets and so forth with the implicit threat of violence. We're seeing all that street theater and histrionics and extremism and refusal to compromise now in the Republican Party, and not only that, it has become institutionalized.
And in the sense that you have, you know, someone like I think you mentioned someone like Steve King and Michelle Bachmann. These are people who 20 or 30 years ago, it would be hard to imagine that they would be elected representatives.
That is true. I guess the thing is, I still, although I'm politically independent, I consider myself somewhat conservative in my sort of general outlook on life. But conservatism, as I understand it, has something to do with Edmund Burke's belief in tradition and moderation, right-wing radicalism is not conservatism.
And you're right that they, the Republicans have become more like an apocalyptic cult. Explain that to me.
Well, I think it became more evident to me, or at least it manifested itself in daily headlines, with the whole business over the debt ceiling crisis. It was kind of, despite the fact that Wall Street was warning, you really don't want to do this, they were saying, bring it on. We don't think it's so bad, and if it is, so what? And that was Michelle Bachmann, who's, you know, not only a member of Congress, duly chosen and sworn, but also a presidential candidate saying that. And that resulted in the first downgrade of U.S. debt since 1917, which is when the ratings agencies started rating these things.
And you also, you know, raise the issue of, and so I guess the idea being is that they're just they're hell bent. I mean, there really is nothing that that can in any way slow their roll, as it were. But you mentioned Thomas Jefferson's Manual of Parliamentary Practice. How does that come to play with what has taken place over the past couple of years?
Well, the Senate, in particular, the House is a majoritarian institution. And the majority rules, but the Senate is one that operates by consensus, and it operates on extremely complex and arcane rules. And if a group or faction wants to use those rules basically to stop anything from happening, they can do it. Now, that does not prevent the Senate from operating in periods of consensus, but at times like these, it is a formula for gridlock, and it's a formula for the failure of the government.
And
when you can't pass appropriation bills, when every time there's a debt limit increase, it becomes the perils of Pauline, when every time there's a piece of major legislation, it's held hostage, a representative government cannot operate that way.
And you suggest in your piece that this is not coincidental. In other words, this is not simply a case of an ideology leveraging the contradictory rules of our government as a way of getting of achieving an end goal. I mean, you actually you lay out that there is almost a transcendent goal that Republicans have that deals with that obstruction actually suits them in another way.
Well, they're not obstructing just for the sake of obstructing or because they don't like this or that bill. When they gridlock Congress, what happens to the public opinion of Congress? It goes down. The last poll I saw had the favorability rating of Congress at a record low 13%. And their belief is, well, we're the party that's against government, so if we trash government, that means we're the relative winners.
And how does that work? I mean, how are they they're the party of government, but I mean, how in practice does it work? I mean, when they trash government, what then follows from that?
I think what happens is a lot of cynicism on the part of the public, and the United States has a very low voter participation rate among most democracies and a very low level of trust among the government. And if you're a group that is stoking that and you have a group of true believers who will vote for you regardless, they become relatively more important and they can sway elections.
Yeah, I mean, so essentially, this is the plan is for Republicans, and I wonder if this is the primary goal or a sort of a, you know, a twofer, like a benefit that they get, that when they create the cynicism, they're actually shaping the electorate. And they're shaping it in a way that, aside from the other things, frankly, that the Republican Party is doing to shrink the size of the electorate and to mold it, they're shaping it in a way that just simply will maintain their power.
Well, when you have seniors basically demonstrating and they're against government spending, well, they're demonstrating against their own Social Security and Medicare. So their attitudes have been shaped by someone.
And, okay, well, we've got to take a break. When we come back, let's go over those principles that you feel that the Republican Party is pursuing above all. You touched on it briefly, but I'm very curious to hear your thoughts on what the party is really standing for and the dynamic between their electoral base and their sort of the establishment of the Republican Party. We've got to take a break. We'll be right back after this. Okay, we are back. And Mike, you were telling us that the Republican Party, one of the benefits to them in obstructing and in some ways crippling our government is that it ties into their ideological sales pitch that government is the problem. It creates a certain amount of cynicism across the electorate and depresses the vote for those who are not as zealous, I should say, as the Republican base. What is this Republican Party now? I mean, what do they actually stand for?
Basically money. I would add that the Democrats also seem to stand for money. They're kind of divided among themselves. There's part of them that sort of thinks they have to fulfill the ideals of the New Deal, but they're still beholden to their contributors. Now, the Republicans, on the other hand, embrace that enthusiastically.
And what, is that just simply baked into the cake of the DNA of the Republican Party?
I believe it is. They've always believed that the business of America is business, not free self-government.
And yet you have at different times, and certainly in the context of the so-called Tea Party, this sort of faux populist movement, is it simply just a straight-on cynicism to energize their electorate? I mean, how do they balance this?
Well, we've never really had a very honest assessment of who the Tea Party is, how they originated. I'm sure that many of them were sincerely angered and distressed by what happened on Wall Street and the direction things have taken. Have they all been co-opted? I'm sure some of them have. We see, you know, American Crossroads and Dick Armey's Freedom Works and the Koch brothers shooting money their way. But we don't know to what extent this is a sincere group and to what extent they've been astroturfed. Unfortunately, the media is not doing a very good job on analyzing this.
And you've written that the faux populist wing of the party, knowing the mental compartmentalization that occurs in most low-information voters, played on the fears of the white working class and to focus their anger on scapegoats so that they basically weren't paying attention to what the Republican establishment was doing in terms of serving corporate interests. And so you suggest that, you know, things like let's build a wall on the southern border, or let's not raise the minimum wage, or it's evil Muslims or evil gays or abortionists. I mean, to what extent also would you include race in that? I mean, to a certain extent, aren't those topics and those sort of groups round two in a way?
Well, racism is sort of the toxic thread that weaves through American history, and I don't really want to cast too many aspersions, but I just have to say they are very good at using language, using code words about, you know, we need to take back America. Well, from whom? That sort of thing. And that is, frankly, where the Democrats are miles behind. Somehow or other, the Republicans know how to speak in the demotic of the average American and make it stick.
And you also mentioned essentially there's three principal tenets of the Republican Party of 2011. The first is that the GOP cares solely and exclusively about its rich contributors. Expand on that. I mean, because, you know, this is what is so fascinating to me in that they have a faux populist movement, as you call it, in the Tea Party that really, empirically speaking, is the Republican base and really more or less the same people. How do they manage this, and how do they manifest their sole and exclusive caring about these rich contributors?
Well, we've seen the manifestation of that now that it's the fourth quarter of the football game. Obama's finally started to put some points on the board, or try, with his jobs program and the so-called millionaire's tax or Buffett tax. And you see how adamantly opposed they are. So I sort of rest my case on that, even though that 75%, I think I read today in the Washington Post, of Americans polled on that issue are in favor of increasing taxes on millionaires. Yet somehow they end up voting for Republicans. There's an kind of split-mindedness among the public in that they know what's going on in Wall Street, but there's, you know, been 200 years worth of, you know, the sort of Horatio Alger myth that you can't tear down the rich and accomplish anything, and that, after all, I might win the lottery.
Right.
Most of us, when we look at our chances realistically, understand that's not the case.
And you say the other tenet is they worship at the altar of Mars. What does that mean?
War all the time. If you look at the main spokesman of the Republican Party, they seem to be champing at the bit. They wanted in 2008 to mix it up with Russia over Georgia. You know, that's really smart, getting involved with a nuclear power. They want to intervene in Iran. Iran has been 2 years from a nuclear weapon for the last 20 years, and they've been agitating about that all the time. Unfortunately, since we have a one-and-a-half-party system, the Democrats aren't much better.
And so tell me the final tenet, the third one is essentially a religious one.
Well, that's the large part of their voting base is evangelical or fundamentalist voters. And that's why we have all these attempts to tinker with the Constitution regarding the federal government rather than the states defining marriage and all this sort of thing.
And so, Mike, give me your sense. I mean, where does this go from here? I mean, you were on the Hill for 30 years. What happens now?
I don't know where it goes. I see now the media had succeeded for about 2 weeks in completely ignoring the Wall Street demonstrations. They finally broken through. I'm wondering if there will be a popular movement to say, let's have a little more, you know, traditional social equity in this country.
You know, when we started this, you said that, you know, at the time that you became a Republican, one of the things you were reacting to was the sense of the left taking to the streets and trying to leverage the idea of social unrest to further their goals. I mean, do you have that same perspective about Occupy Wall Street? And if not, what's changed?
I think the only violence I saw was used by the New York police. They do not seem violent in the least, and I would imagine most people would concede that they have a very valid point, that the average American is not doing very well, and Wall Street is basically walking away with the lion's share.
Mike Loughran, thanks so much for joining us. Fascinating stuff.
Thank you very much.